Harry Huggins stood by the front window of his square white house on Klickitat Street and wondered why Sunday afternoon seemed so much longer than any other part of the week. Mrs. Huggins was reading a magazine, and Mr. Huggins, puffing on his pipe, was reading the funnies in the Sunday Journal. Henry's dog, Ribsy, was asleep in the middle of the living room rug. As Henry looked at him, he suddenly sat up, scratched hard behind his left ear with his left hind foot, and flopped down again, without even bothering to open his eyes. Henry pressed his nose against the window pane and looked out at Klickitat Street. The only person he saw was Scooter McCarthy, who was riding up and down the sidewalk on his bicycle. "I sure wish I had a bike," remarked Henry to his mother and father as he watched Scooter. "I wish you did too," agreed his mother. "But with prices and taxes going up all the time, I'm afraid we can't get you one this year."
"Well, maybe things will be better next year," said Mr. Huggins, dropping the funnies and picking up the sports section.
Henry sighed. He wanted a bicycle now.
That was the opening of Henry and Beezus by Beverly Cleary, and you're listening once again to Clickacast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And this time we are doing Henry and Beezus, the third of the children's books by Beverly Cleary, this one from 1952.
Yeah, 1952, and we're still in the neighborhood, we're still with the, we're back to Klickitat Street, and we're with our gang from the first book.
Yeah, and you know, as I was reading through this book, again, it occurred to me a couple of things. One of the things is, as I was mentioning to you before we started talking, this is one of the two copies of Beverly Cleary books that have survived my childhood. All the other books I will be reading from the books that my own kids bought when they were little. But I had a very bad basement that used to flood a lot, and I lost an enormous number of books into floods. But for some reason, my Henry Huggins and Henry and Beezus survived. And so I'm very grateful for it because it's one of the classic red and yellow covered Henry and Beezus books. And I understand you have one from the 90s.
I have one from the 90s that is less than classic. So yours has like the actual like Lewis Darling illustrations on the cover of the characters.
Right.
Including Ramona Quimby shooting a gun. It's a water gun, but if you don't know the book, it's a little off-putting. Mine has what looks to be a cast members from like any 90s sitcom with a dog that looks absolutely nothing like Ribsy. It looks like a dog out of like Central Casting, like just friendly dog, and a girl playing Beezus and a boy playing Henry that have been painted, but they're obviously based on models because it's very unnatural looking. And they're wearing very modern clothes.
The other thing that occurred to me as I was reading this is this was the first of the books that to me feels like the Henry Huggins I knew and loved as a kid. All the main players are here, finally. Certainly Beezus and Ramona. Ramona comes to the forefront in this book. Mr. Grumby is there for comic relief, and it has that through line, that overarching story that comes to mark all of the Henry books, in this case, Henry's quest for a bicycle.
Yeah, well, I've read this book a few times because I read it for my kids, and rereading it by myself, I actually found that my opinion of it changed a little bit, I guess we can just dive right into it, and find out what this book's about. As the name, the title kind of gives away, Beezus, Quimby plays a much larger role in this book than she did in the first one. And we sort of start hearing Beverly Cleary. You sort of start noticing that Beverly Cleary is starting to take a liking to this character. I think it comes through that she finds Beezus an interesting character. And I find Beezus an interesting character in this book. As will come out, I find Beezus a more interesting character in this book than I find Henry Huggins. should we dive right in?
Sure. And we should make a note, because we didn't note this. Everyone who's read the Henry Huggins books knows this. Beezus is the nickname for Beatrice Quimby, called yes. Beezus because her little sister Ramona couldn't pronounce her name.
Yes. And that becomes a major plot point in the Ramona series.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's go dive into chapter one, Ribsy and the Roast.
Ribsy and the Roast. One of the things that I, right off the bat, that is a recurring theme in this book is the Junior Rose Festival parade, which you will hear them talk about throughout the story. Kind of, it's kind of this like looming incident that's going to occur. All the kids are getting ready for the Junior Rose Festival. And so just a little, like, right up front, the Junior Rose Festival is a real thing if you don't live in Portland. It's been going on since 1907, and it's the oldest and largest children's parade in the United States. So it's a really big deal. Like, kids parade around, and it's understandable that they're very excited about this.
Now, that's fascinating to me because, as a kid, I also thought that Klickitat Street was just something someone made up. I thought the Rose Parade was just some convenient plot device, and I honestly could not understand why the characters of this book were so excited about these municipal celebrations.
I guess the Rose Festival Parade itself is like the adults, and then they started the junior one to show off the kids. And I guess it's hugely attended. It's still going on. If any listeners out there know anything about it, drop us a line because I'd love to see more about the Rose Parade.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it still is going on, but it also really speaks to the kind of post-war setting of this book. This really is prime 50s territory here where the kids are all involved in neighborhood and city activities. And as we mentioned before in the other books, one thing that happens a lot in these books is some instigating incident happens on the street and everyone comes out to see it. And that's very much the plot of this first chapter is something happens on Klickitat Street and eventually the entire neighborhood becomes involved.
Yeah, it's nicely triggered by Ribsy, who doesn't have a whole lot to do in this book, but is an inciting incident in several of the chapters.
Right. So the book starts again with Henry being bored.
Yeah, he's totally bored.
As we've mentioned, this is a very important part of these books. Is the children are on their own to figure out what to do when they're bored, and in Henry's case, he decides to watch his neighbor, Mr. Grumby, who is, strangely enough, setting up a barbecue. And this is treated as though it were some completely exotic occurrence. Henry has no idea what it means for a man to be bringing food outside and burning charcoal briquettes.
Well, yeah, because he's dressed up as a he's wearing an apron with a recipe on it. He's got a chef's hat on. He's good to like it's an event. Like he's making an event of this, and in a way that in modern times you don't. I mean, it's just not a big deal to grill outside, but this is a thing. Like a man cooking meat outside,
right? And you know, after I read this chapter, I thought, am I just imagining this, or is everyone treating this as though it were something particularly peculiar? And I started reading a little bit about barbecue culture in America. There are plenty of websites out there and whole social histories written about this. Now, of course, cooking meat outdoors goes back forever in humanity. But in America, it was prevalent in the South before the World War II and kind of unheard of, certainly in the North, in the Northeast, but also in the Northwest, in the Pacific Northwest, where this is happening. And what part of what happened was in the 20s, with the Great Migration of African Americans moving from the South into city centers like Chicago, they brought with them Southern traditions such as barbecue. And so it was making its way into the larger American landscape, and especially into the suburbs.
Yeah, where it became a real novelty, because at the time we were celebrating our ability, our technologies and our ability to have everything confined to the interior of the house. There was nothing you wanted for inside the modern suburban home. And so it was this sort of throwback, I think probably around the same time that like camping was becoming a thing. Like, get back to nature, get back to the, like, we're losing touch with the world around us in some superficial way.
Right, but on the other hand, Kingsford charcoal became a product at this time. Before then, if you wanted to cook outdoors, it was up to you to burn logs and to make your own embers. Kingsford charcoal came along, and at the same time, enclosed steel grills became marketed for homeowners for the first time. So it was kind of a new thing. And it was also the other thing that is funny about this is how much of a deal is made out of the fact that Mr. Grumby is a man cooking, and how,
yes, oh yeah,
and how absurd that seems to Henry, how absurd that seems to the neighborhood, and how absurd that seems to Mrs. Grumby.
Well, and it's something of a sitcom setup, because he's cooking for his boss. Is that it?
Yeah, he's cooking for important guests. I don't know if it's his boss, but...
Oh, right. There's important guests coming over. He's got to make a good impression, so he's going to cook a barbecue meal. It's quickly established that he knows nothing about cooking. Like, he's trying to go off of a recipe, and his wife is constantly trying to convince him to give it up, cook it inside, because this is not going to come to, like, this is not an, he's not an experienced chef. He does not actually know what he's doing outside. unlike the first chapter of the first book, this chapter introduces every single character in the book shows up in this chapter. This is a long chapter because it spends time giving every single character a moment, a little beat. So you kind of get a feel of who they are. And, you know, we've already met Henry. We met Mr. and Mrs. Huggins. Ribsy, Scooter McCarthy, drives by. Robert's there. Mr. and Mrs. Grumby show up. And what becomes obvious is that Ribsy is attracted to the smell of this meat, this outdoor meat. And normally, Ribsy's unable to cross over into the Grumby's yard because Mrs. Grumby sprinkles Doggy Be Gone on the hedges in between. And unfortunately, it's been rainy, and the Doggy Be Gone seems to have washed off, and Ribsy goes for the meat.
Part of what instigates this is that Ramona and Beezus show up, and Beezus wants to show off her baton twirling.
Right, because she's going to twirl the baton in the parade.
Right, and there's a little bit of physical comedy there with Beezus and her baton, and that's what distracts Henry from keeping an eye on Ribsy, and Ribsy gets into the meat. This seems to be something that Clary likes to do a lot. She likes to try and set up things like a string of dominoes, but I'm not always sure that she needs to do that as much as she does. You know, I have a feeling not at all.
Ribsy would have gotten that meat. Ribsy's going to get the meat regardless. Like, he's unstoppable. Once they know, I mean, they notice Ribsy before Ribsy gets the meat, and Henry goes and tries to stop Ribsy, but he gets caught up in the thorn bushes. Like, it actually describes like that tearing away at his clothes, like trying to get through the shrubs. There's probably a faster way to go around, but he's a kid, he's impulsive, and he heads off through the bushes. I looked it up. I did not realize that Doggy Be Gone is actually a thing that they still sell. You can buy it on Amazon.com.
Really?
It gets the worst reviews. Everyone says it does not work. You can buy it in spray or in powder form. It's actually called Dog Be Gone. But you can get Dog Be Gone, Cat Be Gone, Animal Be Gone, and it doesn't work. You sprinkle it on the bushes, and it's supposed to keep animals from marking, from exploring your yard, and people just say, just forget about it, just do something else. It lasts for like 15 minutes, and then it's pointless.
Well, it sure doesn't work for Ribsy, who goes running off down the street with the roast in his jaws and starts to attract the attention of all the other neighborhood dogs.
And this is another thing I wanted to point out was the concept. I was taking down notes of things that are definite signs of the time that this was written. And one of those is the concept of neighborhood dogs.
Right.
I know when I was a kid, there were some neighborhood, like the idea that people just let their dogs run free. Like, these aren't strays. These are owned by people. They live around the neighborhood. But the mornings, the sun comes up, you open your door and you just let your dog out. Like, people let their cats out. And where I live, we don't have neighborhood dogs. There aren't just dogs running around.
No, I have not seen dogs running around since, I don't know, the 80s probably. But yeah, I do remember dogs running around in the neighborhood. I remember that I actually had a neighbor who was very upset about animals on his property too, and he used to set out traps for them and for small animals, and I tried to keep our dog off of their property, but I also once set a squirrel free from one of their traps, and the neighbor was very angry with me. I always pictured him as sort of a Mr. Grumpy in my head.
Yeah.
But yes, there are many dogs running around Klickitat Street, and they are of wildly different sizes, and it becomes quite clear to Henry that if Ribsy tangles with some of these dogs, he's going to get chewed to pieces.
Yeah, but he kind of throws up his hands. Like, he's so tired by the time it starts that he's like, well, what's going to happen is going to happen.
Right.
And I think that that speaks a little bit to our attitude towards pets at this time. I feel like as dog owners were a little more live and let live with their dogs. I know that pet owners' attitudes toward dogs changed during World War II a lot. That was sort of especially post World War II. There was a much stronger sense that an animal was becoming part of the family as opposed to just a thing you owned. But there was still this sense that, like, dogs are going to fight. Your dogs are going to fight. They're going to mix it up in the streets. It's nothing for us to get involved in. If you care a lot, turn the hose on them. But otherwise, your dog's going to come home sometimes with some bites taken out of them.
Sure. And it wasn't really until, like, the mid-80s and early 90s that the whole spay and neuter your pet PSA thing started taking off. You know, it was kind of a very different world for
it was
animals.
And I think that makes this book very, very of its era. The notion that there's a dog fight in the middle of the street and no one seems to think this is particularly unusual, but they do get the meat away, only it's not Henry that does it.
It's Scooter who comes barreling through on his bike, which becomes, of course, a source of envy for Henry, that Scooter, with enormous savoir-faire, just is able to pedal straight through the midst of these dogs, reach down and grab the roast, which seems kind of improbable to me as an adult. I accepted it as a kid, but it seems kind of improbable to me as an adult. And that also speaks to the kind of crazy, zany pratfalls that are going on at this time, because, of course, Scooter is zipping in and out of these dogs in the middle of the street, certainly without a helmet on, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the expectation was that, you know, kids are going to get into trouble.
Yep. And Henry really wants a bike. One of the things he really wants the bike for is he wants to snap on the raccoon tail from his Daniel Boone coonskin cap onto the handlebars, I believe.
Right.
So it can fly in the wind. But money is tight. His parents don't have the cash to buy him a new bike. And he really wants a new bike.
Right.
And I think that's one of those things, that's something that kind of is going to come up in later books as well, the fact that these aren't affluent people. You get the feeling that many of them are white collar, but you don't really find out what Henry's father really does, but they're not just tossing money around. The prosperity is there post-war, but it's nothing to, like, brag about.
Economy and the ways in which you get money run throughout not just this book but all the Henry books, and then into Beezus and Ramona, where it's much more explicitly made clear that the family is struggling economically.
Oh yeah.
Here it's kind of just dealt with as, well, this is normal. And I think as a kid, I appreciated it because I certainly did not come from a family where you could just get a bike if you wanted a bike. You had to, you had to save up for that, and you had to work for that. And part of that was because my own parents did not have a lot of money growing up. Part of that was, I think, that even as they eventually got into more economic stability, they wanted to impress upon me that I should never take these things for granted.
And, right.
And reading these books, I think, was a a good preparation for that. It's certainly later in later books, Henry goes on to get a paper route, and that figured in my own mythology strongly. I strongly wanted a paper route, and I eventually did get a paper route. I think I'm one of the last boys in America to have a paper route. But
From there, we go kind of into the next chapter. Henry gets out of the scrape by the fact that Mrs. Grumby didn't want to eat that steak anyway. And so he's kind of left blameless at the end of it. I don't think he has to pay anything back for the steak. We do hear more about horse meat, which is something that we hear much less about in this book than we did in the previous one. But So we go into the chapter two, which is Henry Gets Rich, which is one of the most bizarre and fascinating chapters I find in all these books, because there's a level of economy and coincidence and the bizarre windfall he finds and then blows. I find it an extremely frustrating chapter, but just endlessly fascinating. I could pick it apart for hours. But this is one where Henry finds a bunch of abandoned gum in an alley.
Bubblegum balls, the kind that you used to get in vending machines.
Right. It's like a supplier like abandoned his entire inventory, which you find out later is exactly what happened. In the alley, he finds all these boxes of just gumballs, and he finds 49 boxes of gumballs, 49 crates, and he doesn't really know what to do. Like, it's this bizarre thing. Like, it's a bizarre occurrence. Like, he just, if you look at the illustrations, it is a lot of gum. Like, it's it stacks up higher than a child, and he doesn't know what to do. So he goes and enlists Beezus's help to bring this gum home. Right. And Ramona tags along, and for a while it's just this like, hey, my friends, gather around, I'm going to give you some gum. But it eventually becomes a business for young Henry. A very short-lived business, but a business.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, it's a bizarre story. And again, it's one of these things that in the world of today, where as parents we are taught to scrutinize every tiny piece of candy that comes in a child's Halloween basket, this would never fly. It wouldn't have even flown when we were kids, probably.
Right. I found a bunch of gum. Can I keep it? I mean, they do call the police.
Right.
The parents call the police. The dad calls the police to make sure that there's nothing fishy going on. They find out that it was just a guy who had was a gum distributor, and then he was leaving the business, so he just abandoned all of his gum.
Right. That also speaks to the 1950s of just kind of leaving things in an alley.
Well, it also speaks to the fact that, like, how did the police find out about this? Like, did they just go question every gum distributor? Like, we found a bunch of gum. We need to make sure this kid can chew it safely.
Well, they called out the gum squad, of course.
There's literally nothing else happening on Klickitat Street. Well, I guess as we find out in a few chapters, there really is nothing else for the police to do on Klickitat Street. Henry has his gum, and he gets the idea to sell it at school, which is a great idea because he figures out that he's got how many thousands of pieces of gum? Like,
it's like 100 balls per box, so it's
like 200 to 300 balls per box, and so 49 boxes is just. I figured under, out, I did the math.
Yeah. It's just under 5,000 something, I think.
Well, his dad said, yeah, with the amount so he goes to school and he's like, I'm going to charge two cents for a piece of gum, or two gum balls for 1 cent. Is that it?
Yeah,
two gumballs for 1 cent. I think I crunched the numbers. He stood to make, if this scheme had worked, he stood to make, at the high end, $294. Henry could have made $294 if this scheme had worked. Obviously, it's not going to work. You can't get rid of that much like with just your classmates. But he starts out doing well. His first day of selling, he makes like 50 cents, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's like, what, like 50 sales? And his problem, though, is that he starts accepting IOUs. And then he's keeping his books on a piece of, like, on a torn comic book. He's, like, just scribbling in the margins. And he rapidly loses track of who owes him what. Kids start losing interest in the gum. So he starts lowering the price.
Can I just mention that as a young comic collector, it broke my heart to hear that Henry was treating a comic book from 1952 that way.
I remember reading this chapter when I was a kid. The thought of writing in anything I know that, like, at the time, like, comic books were totally disposable. Like, they were just, you read them until they fell apart and then you tossed them.
Right.
So I get that, but it is heartbreaking. I wonder what the comic was.
It could have been a Harvey Kurtzman Mad at that time.
Well, regardless, he screws it all up and he blows his chance. What happens is kids start getting in trouble for chewing gum. He starts losing track of who owes him money. He decides to start offering free samples, which backfires because the kids who owe him money are like, wait a minute, now you're giving this away for free? And then kids who owe him money start collecting other kids' free samples to return gum to him. So he does a terrible job as a businessman. Like, he should have kept cleaner records. Like, get a piece of paper. He's in a school. Like, get a piece of paper. Like, in a pencil. Like, that should be easy to find. He shouldn't have taken out loans. Like, that's the worst thing to do. Like, these are kids. So I had this idea, if you'll bear with me for one second. What he needed to do is he needed to go to school and just mention that he had this gum. Maybe bring along some samples that first day and give out a piece for free. Then the next day, you charge a cent for 4 pieces of gum. Now, at 4 pieces for a cent, he could have still made $147, right? Or you sell it for 49 cents. You sell it for 50 cents a crate. Even then, he could have made like almost $25 selling these crates. Like, he could have made a lot of money. Like, for him, that would have been a lot of money. But instead, he tried to do it piece by piece.
You know what I love about this, Phil, is you're struggling to find a way to make this work.
It could have worked,
and I don't think that was Cleary's point at all about the chapter. I think
I get so frustrated though reading it because I'm like, what are you doing?
Can I ask a question? You know the Frog and Toad stories, right?
Oh, I do know the Frog and Toad.
Now you know
stories.
The one about the cookies.
Oh yeah.
Do you see them getting rid of the cookies to rid themselves of the temptation of cookies? Giving those cookies to birds, do you see that as inherently a triumph or a tragedy?
No, I see that as a triumph.
Okay.
Because the cookies were created simply to be a temptation. The gum is established as a source of income. And it bothers me. I mean, I understand that he's a child. But he should have laid out ground rules for the kids. Don't chew it at school. If you chew it at school, I'm going to deny any knowledge of where you got it. If you do get caught chewing it, you're going to get cut off. What he should have done is he should have made it more of a temptation. Or, like I said, sell it in bulk. 50 cents a crate, that's almost $25. That's so much money to a kid his age at this time. Instead, the whole thing falls apart. He ends up making less than a dollar. Less than a dollar. There was like 17,000 pieces of gum. He couldn't even break buck.
Well, this. I don't think that Cleary wanted to write a 1952 Breaking Bad here. I think that this was a exploration of the ways in which something that seems as though it is a windfall may turn out to be something of a curse. I think that in the end, he could never have sold these anyway because the main reason people didn't want them was they got tired of gum.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He flooded the market.
That's the other thing is he flooded the market. It came out. It seems like a cool thing. That's the other thing. It seems so awesome to like have like an endless amount of gum. And then like after the first day, you're kind of bored of it.
Right.
But it's still about, I think because when he finds that gum, it fills me with so much anxiety. Like, and Cleary does a really good job at playing up the anxiety of finding something cool and not wanting anyone to find out about it because you want it all for yourself, and how he tries to keep any of the other kids from discovering he has 49 boxes of gum initially, and then having to, you know, having to let Bezos in on it, and then having to let Robert in on it, and then having to let Scooter in on it. I think because she establishes the anxiety so well in the beginning, it makes it something that I want to succeed so bad.
Right. Now, Bezos doesn't get a ton of stuff to do in this chapter, although there is a very funny bit between her and Ramona where it's revealed that she keeps Ramona busy by having Ramona pretend to wait for a bus because yes. she thinks it's fun. And if no one tells her it isn't fun, she will keep doing that, which I think is actually quite insightful to the way that kids' imaginations work. But the thing that about Bezos that is so important to this chapter is we're told that Henry trusts her because she's sensible and she understands the situation immediately. And she understands the situation immediately when the gum is found. And she understands the situation immediately when Henry decides at the end he's just taking the gum back and abandoning it again. And
well, we also get to know Bezos. We start learning that she is someone who, even though later on, of course, we find not in this book, we find out that her family's not economically well off. She doesn't try to get in on the action. Like, this isn't like she doesn't try to take advantage of the situation. She simply wants Henry to succeed, and not in a doormat kind of way. She just seems like a genuinely good person who wants to be a good friend and who feels like Henry deserves a leg up.
Right. And the other thing that I would say is this book is shot through with the weird gender politics of kids and of the 50s. I mean, gender politics are still really big with kids in spite of living in more enlightened times. If you're around kids, there's a big deal about who's a boy and who's a girl, and a lot of essentialist thought that goes into kids at that age. And part of the problem that Bezos has with Henry is that Henry generally accepts that Bezos is a smart and capable person, but he constantly wants to put the caveat of for a girl on it.
Yeah, and that's something that actually comes up in a later chapter, and it's repeated enough in this book that when I read it out loud to my younger child, I edit those out because it eventually becomes almost relentless as the book goes on. His internal monologue of she's just a dumb old girl, this dumb girl, these girls, and it made me like it made me uncomfortable after a while. And wondering exactly like what Beverly Cleary was trying to get at, because obviously she's writing a boy's perspective, but from her own perspective. And well, you know, and it comes up much more later on in later chapters. But you're right. There is this. Bezos is shown to be fighting against this perception that, as awesome as she is, it's still with this limitation of being a girl in the neighborhood.
Chapter 3, The Untraining of Ribsy. This is kind of a much weaker chapter.
Oh, really? Because this is one of my favorite chapters.
Oh, is it? That's interesting. Because I didn't remember this when I came back on it. Then I sort of remembered, oh, yeah, this is the chapter that sets up the fact that Henry wants a paper route.
Yeah, like early on.
That doesn't pay off, you know, until a couple more Henry books down the line with Henry and the paper route.
Well, it sets up that Henry is still young.
Right.
And that he is looking for a way to prove himself to the older kids in the neighborhood, especially Scooter. Scooter kind of represents the older kids in the neighborhood. It's a weird chapter because Scooter is portrayed as something of an antagonist again. Even though, like, the attitude is that he's an antagonist, but the reality is that Scooter's just trying to keep his job. And Henry wants, so Scooter's leaving for camp, and just for a few days. And Henry wants to take over the paper route while Scooter's away. And Scooter's like, no, you're too young. You can't do a paper. You don't even have a bike. And Henry's like, well, I'll walk it. And Scooter's like, I don't know. Like, you're supposed to sort of get the idea that Scooter is still, like, being unreasonable. But I think Scooter's being totally reasonable, like, to not want a little kid to screw up his job, to screw up his route.
I remember as a kid finding Scooter to be more of an out-and-out antagonist. And now that I'm an adult, Scooter makes a lot of sense a lot of the time.
Yeah, he does.
And he certainly, he may be a little overly confident in his own abilities, but on the other hand, he does have the skills to prove it. You know, he did pull that roast out from amidst those dogs.
Right.
And he is an older kid who has a paper route and who knows the seriousness about what that means. And it's not, you know, all fun and games for Scooter. And for Henry, it just seems like, I think, a symbol of more autonomy and the opportunity to make more money.
Yeah, Henry resents Scooter because Scooter is what Henry wants to be. Yeah, he's a kid with a job.
Right, and it also shows off really well how just a couple of years makes a huge difference when you're that age.
Right, because they're not, it's not like Scooter is like 16 years old.
Right.
And, but what happens is Henry trains Ribsy to fetch newspapers because he thinks it'd be a cool trick for Ribsy to bring in the newspaper. And unfortunately, Ribsy takes that as a sign to retrieve all the newspapers from the neighborhood. So if Henry's going to become a paper boy, I think is the term, he's going to have to untrain Ribsy, teach Ribsy not to steal the newspapers. There's a phrase used in this chapter that I had to call out. I think they're trying to figure out something to do. I can't remember exactly the context, but they say that it's, let's go to the park. It's been a long time since they waxed the slides by sitting on a bread wrapper. Is probably the most, hey, kids, it's 1952. If you were born any time after this, you're not going to have an... I don't know what is going on, why you would wax the slides by sitting on a... I don't know what that means.
It
sounds like a... No, well, I have no idea.
It means... Well, before bread was wrapped in plastic, it was wrapped in wax paper.
Yeah.
So it means to take a sheet of wax paper and to sit on it and slide down one of those tall aluminum slides. And the idea is that that will greatly cut down the friction and you will go down super fast. Now,
I've never heard of anyone doing this.
Oh, really? If you remember back in those days when playgrounds were meant to kill children.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They had slides that were fully 15 feet off the ground. You would go down those things pretty fast. And you could go down them even faster if you slid on something that cut down the friction. So that was what that was about. I mean, I remember...
Did you do this? Did you, like, wax the slide?
I didn't call it that, but I did use wax paper a couple times.
Oh, my gosh. I've never heard of it.
And
I feel like I missed out on something.
And I did end up falling face forward into the gravel at the bottom of the slides.
Well, of course you did, because it was just huge pieces of metal on asphalt and, like, stones. They're like, we'll put down some stones so the kids will have something to land on. But, no, I read that on page 91. I was like, wax the slides by sitting on a bread wrapper. Beverly Cleary, what are you even talking about? Like, I suddenly felt like I was had found myself wandering through Klickitat Street in 1952, like, as, like, a man from 2016, like, not understanding what was going on. But this also introduces Ramona's water pistol. Ramona runs around screaming, "You're dead," quite a bit in this chapter, which I find delightful and very off-putting. It's the image from the cover. I also realized that the picture of Ramona on the cover where she's holding the gun and squirting it, there's also a picture of, I think it's Henry Huggins' head on that cover.
Uh-huh.
Like it looks to be in her line of fire.
Right.
And it almost perfectly lines up with the famous photo from Vietnam.
Oh God!
And now every time I see the cover, I can't not think of that horrifying photograph. That was a little tangent. That was my little dip into history there for you. But the long story short is that Ramona, they get the idea from Ramona shooting Ribsy that if you shoot Ribsy with the water pistol, every time he picks up a newspaper, Ribsy's going to be untrained. He's not going to want to pick up the paper anymore. Negative reinforcement.
Right.
They negatively reinforce this poor dog mere hours after positively reinforcing this poor dog.
Right. Well, this was around the time that B.F. Skinner was starting to make headlines. So
right.
It's trickling down into Clickitat Street.
Yeah, I guess we're lucky they didn't put give Ramona a wire mother or something.
A few more years, they would have given him a button.
Yeah.
Told him every time you press this, Ribsy gets a shock. Anyway,
We also are introduced to Robert saying that a good way to untrain Ribsy would be to hit him. Hit him, Robert yells. Which I think is something that people, unfortunately, did a lot more to dogs back in the day in order to negatively reinforce something. But Henry can't bring himself to hit Ribsy. He's a good owner. Also, we hear about Army surplus canteens, which I don't think kids run around with quite so much anymore. And water pistols in general. I just don't see kids with as many water pistols as even when I was a kid, kids used to have. It was just a thing.
Yeah. Today they have the big super soaker things that are the comically large. Nobody could possibly mistake them for anything. I remember as a kid, I had a water pistol that looked like a Luger.
I had a water pistol that looked like a submachine gun.
Oh, God.
And it was battery operated, so it would shoot repeating blasts. It looked like almost like an Uzi. And it had a cartridge. Like you would fill the cartridge with water and then pop it in the bottom. Like you would chamber it. It was amazing. But you know, you can't get those anymore. At least not in America. At least not at reputable stores. But you're right. That's that book. That's that chapter. And that's pretty much what happens is you don't actually find out what happens with that. Squitter.
Well, they do end up untraining Ribsy, and Henry presents this to Scooter as though now it's a fait accompli that Scooter's going to turn over his route to Henry. And I assume we were left to assume that. I always kind of thought as a kid, if Scooter didn't like Henry, why didn't he just say no and find someone else?
I think it's that kid rules thing, the politics of being a kid. Like, Henry asked first, and even though, he's not one of your peers, I don't know, it's that thing that keeps drawing Scooter back to this group of kids. Like, maybe Scooter doesn't have a lot of friends nearby, or maybe Scooter doesn't have a lot of friends. Like, maybe he just doesn't know anyone.
Yeah, well, again, as with Henry Huggins, there's a lot of sitcom rules. With the Nightcrawlers and Henry Huggins, it was just the rule that Henry could not tell his dad what had happened, and then even after he told what had happened, he had to get the Nightcrawlers because that was the path they had headed down, I guess.
Well, it is. It's very Leave It to Beaver-y. It's very the kids are their own little fiefdom in the neighborhood. Like, there's just there are agreements that are unspoken and unwritten that kids understand, and I think this goes a long way towards illustrating that. Like, Scooter didn't go to his parents to ask who should take over the route. Henry didn't go to his dad to ask, should I take over Scooter's route? Like, there was no negotiation. It was all between the kids. And so I think, and it is that whole thing of, this is your cast. Like, your cast is going, knows to interact with the cast. Like, at the end of the chapter, Scooter had been like, oh, I asked Thomas. I asked Thomas on the other street. Like, that would have been weird. Like, who, what, who? Like, that doesn't make, what? Like, we don't know this character. So, they understand your basic rule, which is keep it in the cast.
Right. Now, chapter 4, Henry Parks' dog. I just wanted to call out that at the beginning of this chapter, Ramona and Beezus show up at Henry's door eating cabbage cores.
Yes, cabbage cores. I was so taken aback by that. I actually looked that up to make sure I knew what they were talking about. I was like, it couldn't just be the core of a cabbage. And I guess it is.
Yeah, sure.
And if you needed a hint that there was some economic issues going on in the Quimby household, the fact that their children are showing up at your door eating what is pretty much considered garbage to a lot of people, I think there's your clue. There's your clue. The kids show up eating cabbage cores as a snack. It's a fun snack.
Well, you know, when I cook cabbage, I sometimes eat the core afterwards. I don't know. Maybe that just makes me weird.
And do you walk around the neighborhood eating what you get? They're polite enough to stop munching on their cabbage cores, though, when the door is open. Like, they know that's at the time you just hold that cabbage core in your hand.
Well, the answer is yes. I put on my overalls and my Daniel Boone coonskin cap, and I walk around the neighborhood eating my cabbage core, looking for fences to whitewash.
I'm going to do that as soon as I have another cabbage core, because I'm going to actually try one. I'm going to try snacking on a cabbage core the next time I have one.
They're fairly sweet, but they're very sharp flavored.
Yeah, I bet. But I guess, you know, like, what else are you going to do? It's hot outside. Eat a cabbage core. They show up to... Beezus shows up because she's the most wonderful person on the planet. She shows up with a note that says that, hey everyone, there's going to be a bike auction in the neighborhood at the police station. And she's so kind that she brought this flyer to show Henry and be like, hey, this bike auction's tomorrow. I think you may be able to get a cheap bike because I know you really want a bike. And your heart goes out to this sweet girl who just wants to help out this boy in her neighborhood.
At first, you know, that does score her an in with Henry, but we'll see that all fall apart in the next chapter.
Well, Henry's immediately starts, like, in his internal monologue, he's like, dumb old girls. I don't want no dumb old girls following me, because they get... His mom is like, well, since Beezus was nice enough to bring this to your attention, you should let her go with you, which, of course, means Ramona has to go with you, which ends up becoming... You have to keep pace with them, which ends up becoming, if they need to go home early, you have to go home. Like, the rule keeps resetting itself, even though the mother only said Beezus and Ramona have to go with you. The rule keeps changed. The goalpost keeps moving in the kids' minds. Like, in Henry's mind, he's like, well, if Beezus and Ramona gotta go, I gotta go too, because it stops being let them come along to you have to stick with them like glue the whole time. Which causes a problem, because Ramona's not the fastest person in the world, nor is she the most agreeable person in the world, nor is she older than, what, three? Like, she has to be, like, what, 3 years old? Henry's only got $4.14 to go bid with at this auction. And they start heading out to the auction and noticing that other kids are heading there. And then Ramona's like, I'm hungry! So they stop at a grocery store, and this is the part that, even as a kid, like when I read this book, it just bothered me so much. Like, Henry takes time going into the grocery store. Like, he's like, to me, if you're in that much of a hurry to get to this bike auction, like, just go. Like, just get. But he's hungry too, so he goes in and he's like trying to choose food to eat.
Right before that, there's the little deal with Mrs. Wisser.
They get stopped by a neighbor.
A neighbor who's this very kind of prissy older woman who wants to remark on the girls' dresses, and Henry is frustrated. But Ramona actually turns out to be an asset at this point, because when Mrs. Wisser asks Ramona what she has in her pocket, she pulls out an enormous slug. And this charmed me no end when I was a child. I thought this was the greatest thing. And, of course, it sets up a lot of... what we come to love about Ramona over these books, which is her being this force of anarchy in an otherwise, a legitimately Leave It to Beaver neighborhood. She's going to throw a monkey wrench into people's expectations.
Right, right. I think that's a great point, is that up to this moment, the whole neighborhood is super sitcom-y. And it's only when we branch off really into the Ramona books that Beverly Cleary starts breaking those expectations and showing you characters sort of behind the scenes of a sitcom, like really delving into what's going on in these people's heads. I like the notion that Ramona is your first sign that there is going to be something anarchic coming into your expectations. This child who is going against what you would expect a little girl to do.
Right. Now,
Mrs. Wisser wouldn't have stopped them in the first place if the girls hadn't been with Henry, I want to point out. Because sure. She wanted to talk about Ramona and Beezus.
Right. Now, that's Henry's talking in your head there.
Oh, this is where he starts getting bad.
Yeah, yeah.
With the dumb old girls and the, like, what's the point of women? And he doesn't actually say that, but man, he really starts hammering it home in this chapter.
Right. Now, as you mentioned, they go into the grocery store, and Henry doesn't. Henry, of course, is externalizing all of his anxiety and impatience, but he, as much as anyone else, is complicitous in going in and wasting time at this grocery store.
Yeah.
And when they come out,
especially after the Mrs. Whisser stop, like, I always found that, like, God, wouldn't you just be like, just champing at the bit to get to that auction? But I guess if you got to get 10-cent chips, like, you got to get chips, and he does. He gets chips for 10 cents, and they say, and he ties Ribsy, because Ribsy keeps following him into the store. He ties Ribsy to a parking meter, and when he comes out, Ribsy has a ticket.
Henry has absolutely no idea what to do. He kind of falls to pieces, and his little kid mind is racing with, like, all the possibilities of what this would be like.
And Scooter, is it Scooter and Robert stopped by?
Sure.
And they were like, didn't you put a penny in the meter? And I'm like, oh, a penny in the meter.
Yeah.
And then Robert says that his dad got a ticket once, and he had to pay $1, or maybe it was $2.
Yeah.
And so Henry sees his $4.04 since he spent money on chips. His $4.04 like rapidly becoming $3. And he doesn't. And he keeps like re-justifying what kind of bike he might be able to buy in his head. He's like, well, maybe I can get one with one wheel. Well, maybe I can get one. Maybe if it doesn't have handlebar. Like, he keeps like sort of like lowering his expectations as to what kind of bike he's going to get.
Beezus has the sensible notion that they're on their way to the police station anyway for this auction. Why not just ask a policeman when they get there?
Yeah.
And again, showing a lot more grace under pressure than Henry shows through most of this book. They show up, and the policeman is a typical unhelpful adult in that he sits around kind of chuckling at the kids.
You can taste the Irish accent, even though it's not pointed out. You're like, oh, right. I know who this guy is.
Right.
But yeah, they make their way to the auction is happening like at the police station, and the police are mostly trying to herd the kids. Like, it takes them a while to find a police officer who'll listen.
Right.
And then they just get made fun of.
Right.
And even though a police officer gave a ticket to a dog, like, this wasn't even a joke. Like, a police officer legitimately gave a ticket to Ribsy because you're not supposed to tie anything to a parking meter.
Yeah. And this does happen a lot as a kid, you know, grown-ups do something and you make the mistake as a kid of treating it seriously. And then grown-ups find that hilarious
that
I mean, what is Henry supposed to do? But the cop just kind of chuckles and says, oh, we can take care of this.
Well, he's like, well, since you didn't know it was against the law, I'll let it go. And I'm like, I guess in my mind, I'm like, was he actually going to make this kid pay? Like, I guess they didn't know it was a kid. It could have been an adult. Like, I guess if it's against the rules, but I don't know. It made me angry at the police officer. Cause I'm like, just tell the kid. Okay. Like, but instead it becomes a thing to laugh at a kid about. But of course, it successfully, dramatically makes Henry feel even more powerless, which is kind of how he's feeling right now. Like, this whole chapter is about him wanting something and just him watching his opportunities slipping through his fingers.
This chapter does the thing where it goes directly into the next chapter.
Into the next chapter.
Which is Beezus Makes a Bid, which takes place at the auction, which turns out to be something of a madhouse.
Oh, it's terrible. Like, it got my blood pressure up. Like, hearing about this, because even the auctioneer is like unable to hear the crowd because it's just such a, it's just so many kids.
Right. And Scooter and some other kids of the peanut gallery are shouting out joke bids. And I have a hard time imagining such a pressing crowd for a police auction of bicycles. I haven't been to one for a while. Actually, I haven't ever been to one.
It said that there was going to be 100 bikes available, and it ends up being 50 bikes, which is kind of a big problem. Henry's convinced he's going to be able to get a bike, but it quickly becomes obvious that, like, he can't even be heard over the crush of the crowd. And the first thing I had to look up in this chapter was they announced that a Tailor Tot is for sale. And I had to look up what a tailor tot was, because Henry's like, I didn't know there was going to be tailor tots here. And the first time I read this out loud to my kid, Mitzi was with me, and I was like, I don't know what a tailor tot. Like, we actually looked it up together, because she was, it's basically like a little two seater, or like a one, like it's not a stroller, it's like a four wheel baby cart thing you push a baby around in. Like, it's just something that you don't see anymore, I guess. But, yeah, you wouldn't expect one of them to be at a bike auction.
There's not a ton of plot in this chapter, but it is a good sustained sense of anxiety and...
Oh, yeah.
And just hubbub. It did make me very nervous as a kid reading this through.
Yeah.
I think the first few times I read this book, I actually kind of nervously skipped ahead because I was so worried about what was going to happen.
I actually did that when I was going through it one last time. I was like, but it shows ingenuity on Ramona's part. She has that young child. She's figured out how to get her way.
Right.
And when it doesn't work by screaming constantly, which she does, about being hungry, she starts screaming, I'm gonna throw up. And when I first read this as a kid, that was the first time I ever realized that's a brilliant move in a crowd. Like, if you yell, I'm gonna throw up, people let you out. And so Ramona keeps yelling that, and this woman, this awful woman, who I just cannot stand, who's behind the kids, keeps like tapping the kids on the shoulder and being like, you need to get that little girl out of here. And Beezus is like, no, she's faking. She does this all the time, but the woman doesn't listen to her, and like escorts the kids out of the auction. Like, and they don't have – it's a good example of the fact that we are kids existing in our own world, playing by our own rules, following our own politics. But when an adult steps in, even if it's a stranger, when an adult steps in, you have to do what the adult says. Like, they know that once the woman puts her foot down, they have to follow her out of the auction.
When they leave the auction, they find that Ramona has disappeared. And so now they're casting about trying to figure out what's going on. And, of course, Beezus, being a better person than Henry, is just concerned about a little lost girl. Henry is concerned that he's losing every possible chance he has at an auction here. But when the auctioneer announces that there is a little girl at being held up at the front, Beezus is able to make her way to the front. And this is where Henry strikes while the iron is hot and says, Beezus, put in a bid for me.
Yeah, like, you're up front. They can hear you. You just, here's how much money I have. Just put in, get something for me.
And she does.
She does.
And of course, it turns out to be a girl's bike.
That's like, that is the end of the chapter. Like, the words, I think girl's bike are the last words in the chapter. Like, it's a girl's bike.
In the 70s, I had a hard time understanding this. I mean, I knew a lot of kids who just rode around on whatever bikes were available. But obviously, gender looms heavy in Henry's little mind.
We knew what girls' bikes and boys' bikes were growing up. Like,
yeah.
Like, I knew guys who wouldn't ride a bike that didn't have the bar.
Right.
Even though that was really the only difference. It was a big deal. I mean, when I was a kid, like, obviously bikes had a lot more cartoon characters and stuff on them too. But it's a sort of a blow. Like, Henry spent his money and he's gotten a bike that he doesn't think he could ever ride. And then in the next chapter, Henry's bargain bike, which is kind of a useless chapter. Like, nothing really happens in it. Like, it is pretty much Henry not appreciating his friends who come by to try to, like, legit try to help him out. Like, he's trying to fix this cruddy bike and figure out, because it's not only is it a girl's bike, it's also falling apart. Like, it's in bad shape. And he's trying to fix this bike, and, like, Scooter comes up and is like, hey, that front wheel's pretty bad. Why don't we attach your bike to my bike? We can have a tandem bike, and we can ride in the parade that way. Like, I feel like Scooter is legitimately trying to help Henry out in this. Like, he's not making much. He makes fun of him as much as Scooter's going to, but then he tries to, like, offer some advice. And, like, they're like, put a, you know, paint a broom handle and make it the bar. And, like, Henry is so intent on not listening to his friends and showing them that he can take care of this himself that he actually ends up breaking his bike even more by over-tightening the spokes.
Right. Have you over-tightened bike spokes?
No, I have never.
Oh, my God. As a kid, I tried to do it a couple times. And I do a lot of stuff around the house these days. I do electrical wiring. I will fix concrete. I will do light plumbing. I will not tighten bike spokes. That goes to a shop. That is like.
Is it just?
It is finicky as all hell. It is the most. Yeah? It's a constant game of whack-a-mole because you tighten one side and suddenly the other side is loose, and you know, I don't know. I'm sure there's a trick to it, and listeners, if you know the trick, don't write in because I don't want to know it.
Well, he's so intent on doing it himself that he tightens them so much that he bends the wheels out of shape. Like literally he's trying to ride it and it's just a wobbly mess because the everything's just screwed up. He screws it all up, like, beyond repair.
Right.
Which just, that's it. Like, that's the chapter. Like, he acts like a jerk to his friends. He ruins his bike even more. And then we go on to the...
It is a kind of a garbage chapter as far as plot goes, but it is not... the one thing I'll say about it is it does show that mindset you can get into when you are really going to be your own worst enemy because you've convinced yourself that you've been wronged. You convinced yourself that you can do this and you don't need anyone else. And that is not, unfortunately, that is not simply the domain of children. That's certainly something I deal with as an adult all the time myself. So.
Well, it's pretty much whenever I try to do anything around the house. Like, we have a handyman who comes that I call, and he's usually coming to fix the things that I've tried to repair in the house. Large holes in the ceiling, wiring I've screwed up, water stains from various projects I've had to abandon. So I know the feeling. I know getting in so deep. I guess I feel like Beverly Cleary is still... As an author, is still learning how to do it write this kind of thing in a way that Henry doesn't come across. I feel like, I don't know. There's just the chapter's not finessed enough to sell it. He just ends up looking like a belligerent jerk,
right?
And it makes what happens in the next chapter a little not seem to pay off as much because I kind of don't want him to accidentally succeed again, which is what happens in the next chapter. He accidentally succeeds.
Right.
Now in a chapter that is almost its own movie. It's so bizarre and like out of left field. I'm like, what is happening? Like, it's called The Boy Who Ate Dog Food and it becomes a whole psychodrama in and of itself.
No, I think you're right. I think you could take this chapter alone and make it into, certainly a short story, but you could possibly pad it out into a children's chapter book. It goes through a lot of stuff, and it's and just as we opened with a long, crazy chapter that really situates us in the 1950s, we end with a crazy long chapter that situates us in the 1950s. Insofar as the motivating factor for this chapter is the opening of a new supermarket,
yes,
which is also treated like something.
It's an event.
An event from the future.
Yeah, it's basically like the world of tomorrow. Like, people will show up, they are bringing their families, there are prizes, there are free samples, which is a huge deal. And, but there's a raffle. Like, you get tickets and you could win from. Obviously, it's not divided up. Like, you don't put into the... It's not a silent auction or anything. Like, you don't get to choose what you're raffling for. It's just a big... Just a mess of prizes. And we end up... Henry is... I don't even... He goes... They're looking for free samples, and they end up at the dog food display. And the guy, like, he's like, do you have free samples? And the guy's like, you know what? If you, hello, child. If you eat some of this dog food, I'll give you a free can. And Henry sees, like, A, that's a that's illegal. But also, Henry sees this as almost an opportunity. Like, I think this speaks to the child in him, which is to be the kid who eats dog food would almost be like the best thing in the world.
Right.
Because that would kind of make you cool.
Right.
But
the salesman here is such a, again, like out of central casting, you know, he's sort of like a poor man's Willie Loman that he's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's just going to like, say, kid, what do you think? And again, with the health code violations and the Department of Social Services would swoop in on this so fast, but
yeah, he's sitting there. The guy's like, "Hey, you know, like eat," and it goes on for a while. The kids are like, "Do it, do it! Don't be a scaredy cat! Come on, do it!" And the other kids are like, "He's scared to." He's like, "I'm not scared to eat it," and. The guy like opens up a can, and Beezus is the only one there who's like, "Don't do it, Henry. Don't do it. Don't do it." And he's in a position where he's going to have to do it to prove he's not scared. When his name gets called over the loudspeaker,
right?
That he's won a prize,
right?
Which seems to okay. So this is the weird like. Psychologically, this story has gone from like, "Hey kid, eat some dog food," to Henry being like, "If I eat dog food, I'll be awesome, but I don't want to eat dog food." To the kids pressuring him to eat dog food, so he's like feeling like, "I don't want to have to do this." To a voice announcing, "Henry Huggins," he's like, "Saved." To going up on stage to accept a prize that he doesn't know what it is, and the prize is what, $50. Worth of gift certificates to the local beauty salon,
to the Colossal Market's own beauty shop. This is a beauty shop right within the marketplace.
I forgot to establish that at the beginning of this chapter, which is weird to me. They don't establish this earlier in the book, but Henry starts talking about this specific bike that he wants,
right?
And it's a red bike that he sees in a window that costs $59.95. Which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
In fact, I went to an inflation calculator. $59.95 in 1952 is the equivalent of $543.48 today.
Wow.
That's a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it also means that Henry just won the equivalent of $453 worth of gift certificates to the local beauty salon. And it's not like this was written by someone who didn't have an idea of like what 1952 money was. This was written in 1952. So Henry is handed a windfall. Like, here you go, kid. Here's $450 worth of gift certificates. And he almost throws it away because, like the policeman earlier in the book, this is seen as an opportunity by everyone in the town to humiliate a child by laughing at him on stage, even though it's like, here's $50, kid. And everyone's like, ha ha, that loser just got $50.
Right. But of course, this has also been prefigured by the gum. And it's Beezus who points out to Henry what a windfall it is, because she offers to purchase one of the gift certificates from him. For less than it's worth. But at that moment, it's that moment of doing that that changes everything for Henry. But
right.
Similarly, it was Beezus's help with the gum that turned that in from something that was just a personal windfall for Henry to chew on his own into a possible economic benefit. And here again, you know, Beezus, one wishes that Beezus had would get a finder's fee or something for this, because,
well, I guess what I was left with, because she makes the offer and that's what gives him the idea to to sell these. In long story short, he does. He sells. He makes a deal with adults who are going to just give him the equivalent amount of each gift certificate. So he makes, you know, 40 some dollars from all this, because Bezos buys one for less than it's worth. But it left me wishing that Bezos had, from a dramatic standpoint, I would have had Bezos be even more active in it. Like if Henry had actually thrown away the gift certificates and then had Bezos fish them out of the garbage for him and say like, no, you can say, I wanted her to be a little more, have a little more agency, because as it stands, I didn't get the kids person. Like I wanted one of the kids to have a revelation. And in the end, it just sort of seemed to happen, which left it feeling a little bit more like Henry fell into the answer to his problems again, which is kind of what happened in the first book with the football. Like, luckily the guy stopped and gave him the football back. And in this one, I felt like, well, fortunately, out of hundreds of people, Henry won $50. And I guess I wanted to see, because the book is called Henry and Bezos, I wanted to see them come together a little bit more as friends or as partners, or to her play even a more active role in his success. I felt like that would have just been more dramatically satisfying for me as a reader.
Yeah, I agree with all those things. And as I think about this book now, you know, as a kid, I never thought about issues of theme when I read books. I just wanted them to have lots of incident. I was really interested in there being a good amount of plot and for it to be very, very funny. But
yeah.
Now, as an adult, I'm kind of puzzling over the theme of this book, because on the one hand, it's about working toward your goals, but on the other hand, it's a book about being open to opportunity and seeing opportunity when it comes. And sometimes we mistake things for windfalls that aren't really windfalls, and sometimes we almost miss the opportunities we have. And in Henry's case, tellingly, he almost misses this opportunity once again because of gender categories. He sees this as like, these are gifts to a beauty salon. He's a boy, therefore they are worthless to him, rather than seeing them in kind of that cold, practical way that Bezos suggests. And
I guess, yeah, you know, no, I agree with that.
But you know, but maybe I'm trying to, after the fact, give a better spin on this than maybe the book itself had. I mean,
right. I guess if that's the case, this is only Beverly Cleary's third book. She's still learning like her ways around, like even just building a through line through a book. Even though I felt that Ellen Tebbets had a really nice through line. Like, it sort of started with a relation. It was a story of a relationship between two girls, and that carried through. This one was still very episodic, like the first Henry Huggins book. And I feel like, the Henry Huggins books kind of stay that way, as Beverly Cleary starts obviously developing more of an interest in the Quimby family, but I do wish that Henry had learned a little bit more at the end, rather than just sort of stay old Henry. Once he realizes he's got the money, like that's it. Like he's done. Like there's no like, wow, I wanted a lesson at the end. Like as cheesy as it sounds, like I guess I wanted to know what the whole point of it was.
Well, maybe the point just is sometimes you get a bike.
Yeah, sometimes you get a bike. Sometimes you throw your hat into the ring and you get a bike. Sometimes you think terrible things about your friends and you don't learn anything new about them. Like they will remain dumb old girls, presumably until high school, but we never really go that far. But I know I said this at the beginning, but I do get the sense that Beverly Cleary is starting to like Bezos a lot as a character. And even though I was, as a child, always a Ramona fan, as I'm reading these books now, it's Beezus who is the one who I'm seeing as the one who is really on this journey. From the first book until the end of this whole entire series. I guess Ramona picks up the slack later on, but in this book, I see the seeds of that character really starting to shine. And like you said, I see the seeds of Ramona as the neighborhood's Tasmanian devil, like really starting to come to the fore. I can see readers like demanding more of them.
Right. I think that's an interesting point, and we will, in a few books here, come to Beezus's shining moment in Beezus and Ramona. And I think it's an interesting question whether or not that would have been an alternative way to go for Beezus to have become the out-and-out star of the books rather than how Ramona eventually did. Beezus certainly doesn't disappear from the Ramona books, and her relationship with Ramona is very strong through those books. But I think that you're right. I think that something happens, and I remember being very struck by Beezus and Ramona as a kid. That I thought that was something different. I didn't read the Ramona books until I was much older, so I didn't realize that Clary had even more to go after that.
Well, what I intend to do, like my perspective is on this next read through, is I'm going to intentionally attempt to read the Ramona series, the upcoming books, as Beezus's narrative. Like that's kind of my goal, and see if it works, especially when the shift of perspective, when it shifts to the perspective, Ramona's perspective, to see if it still works as Beezus's narrative. We're simply seeing it through the eyes of a child. Like I still think Beezus grows in very subtle ways as the whole series comes on, and you only get to see that through Ramona's eyes. This, in my opinion, extremely dynamic character, like coming into her own. So that's my personal scholarly goal for the rest of this read through is tracking Beezus. That's gonna be my subtitle. Click It Cast, Tracking Beezus.
You've been listening to Click It Cast with hosts Phil Gonzalez and John McCoy. You can find Phil's podcast, Deep in Bear Country, and John's podcast, Sophomore Lit, wherever you buy fine podcasts. If you'd like to support Click It Cast, now you can. The Incomparable Network has a membership system that lets you sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up for a membership. You'll be asked to pick the shows on the Incomparable Network you'd like to support. If you only check the box for Click It Cast, your entire contribution will come to us, after fees are taken out, of course. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members will receive extras including exclusive bonus audio tracks, a live bootleg feed of The Incomparable, and other cool stuff. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. So again, if you'd like to support Click It Cast, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thanks in advance.